Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Weather State Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, today it's raining outside, but it is not snowing. And no more snow days, but
we're back to the grind. But actually, we didn't quit.
Right.
Last Wednesday, when everybody else was advised to stay home.
Drinking beer in the afternoon.
You, me.
Yeah.
Ramey from Ramey Films.
Yes, RameyFilms.com.
And Secret didn't make it. He was drinking beer in the afternoon. And Dr. Andre Pavlov,
yes,
at a Vancouver Real Estate Live, 7 p.m. last Wednesday. Fantastic time.
Phenomenal, phenomenal interview with Andre Pavlov. And that's actually available on our YouTube channel. But also, like, many people showed up.
Yeah, which was great. It was good. It was an eventful chat room. And we should kind of clarify, right? Because it wasn't just an interview with Andre Pavlov. It was Andre, the three of us basically just had a beer and, talked real estate, answered questions, engaged.
Yes.
Some people had some very interesting points, and it was a strong hour. Maybe the highlight of my week.
Yeah. You know what? It was a lot of fun. I think Andre had a good time as well. But that is available on YouTube. We also talk about strata insurance deductibles. We covered the market. What else did we cover? Property taxes, like lots going on in that conversation.
Yeah, it was
and
a good
some
one.
Pretty good jokes.
Yeah, and you know what? Strata insurance, now that you say that, next week we got somebody on, an insurance broker, talking about strata insurance. So if you're reading about that and you're wondering why we haven't talked about that yet, that's next week. But let's not bury the lead, because
yes,
this is one of the most exciting episodes we've had in some time.
Yes.
We got the guys, the intelligentsia from Rennie here.
We do. We've got Andrew Ramlow, who's the VP, and then Ryan Berlin, who's the senior economist at Rennie Intelligence, a division of Rennie Group. And you know what, Matt? Like, we actually strategically saved this interview for the beginning of 2020 just because we wanted to start the year off with a bang.
We started talking to these guys a long time ago about coming on the show. And you're right. We said, okay, well, wait a second. Like, 2019's turning out to be a strange fall. Let's hold off. Let's unpack the fall in January and let's talk about the new year and what their predictions are. It's a fantastic conversation. And this is, just so everybody knows, there's three kind of divisions of Rennie as far,
yes,
as I understand, right? There's the real estate brokerage, there's the project marketing side of things, and then there's Rennie Intelligence, this independent group of very smart guys just running different types of analyses, and they came on to share it.
Yeah, fantastic people over at Rennie. And
let's get to our this week's Oakwin tip.
We got the Oakwin tip.
Yes. So Oakwin, this is our new brokerage. So happy to be over at Oakwin. Such an exciting, dynamic place. The Oakwin tip this week involves home insurance. But
right,
not in the way that you might be thinking if you're thinking about water deductibles. The Oakwin tip is, always line up your home insurance with your completion date.
Yes.
The risk of the property falls to the new owner on the completion date. So just to unpack this a little bit, Adam, there's of course the completion date in which your name goes on title or comes off title. But if you're buying a property, goes on title, the money changes hands. Then usually the next day or a couple days later, there's the possession and the adjustment date. Often people think the adjustment date is when you should put the insurance on the new property. Wrong. It's the completion date. Even though you don't necessarily take possession, you don't get the keys,
right,
on the date of completion, you are responsible. You need insurance.
You do.
You don't want to get caught without insurance.
We heard an example of that where somebody had a
something
leak.
Something just happened in East Van.
Basement, yeah,
leaked on the day of completion.
Yeah, and the buyer's insurance kicked in.
The buyer's
insurance.
That is correct. Yeah,
exactly.
The buyer's insurance kicked in. But Adam, you got your own tip this week.
Yes, Matt, my tip this week, and we should say, I was never a huge fan of the AirPods.
You were not. You were actually, of anyone who came on this podcast, almost everybody says that's the one thing they'd buy, and you bought them.
I bought them, yeah.
You bought them early.
I have stuff like that. I just I thought I'd use them all the time.
I thought you would too.
Yeah.
I've never seen anything like it. It was a disaster.
No. I lost them. I'd keep them in the car. I'd never wear them. Anyways.
But you got a tip.
Until I figured this out, and this is my tip this week, you can actually watch movies and shows and Netflix on Apple TV.
I thought you were going to say on your phone.
No. Yeah. Groundbreaking tip. This was like last week's Bop It, which I got a lot of flack for. Yeah, for bringing that up. It turns out everyone but us knew that which game that was.
Yeah.
But here's the tip though. The tip is that you can actually connect your AirPods with Apple TV, so you can like watch movies and stuff at home on your AirPods. And not disturb your 6-month-old baby if you have one.
For instance,
Or your wife or your husband.
And the sound is incredible, right? It's like the sound is like surround sound.
It's unbelievable.
In your head.
Yeah. I was watching a documentary where like a jet took off and it's crazy. It feels like you're in a theater.
It's a good tip.
So I'm on to the AirPods.
Right. Right on. Well, what else do we got before we go to our talk with Rennie Intelligence?
Well, yeah, you know, we should just a shout out to RaimiFilms.com. Matt, also live at the Bento. RaimiFilms.com.
He made it through. I think he came on snowshoes.
He did. Yeah. He came out to the studio on snowshoes over the snow day. And Raimi's always great. And man, he's doing great work over there.
He's doing God's work over there. The other thing is late last season,
right.
If in 2019, we had Epic Alliance on the show.
Right.
A lot of people have reached out. They're that Saskatoon firm that's doing really interesting work with really incredible returns. Their director of sales is coming out to Vancouver on Thursday for a week.
Right.
Sounds like they've had a lot of interest. The buy-ins are cheap. The returns are fantastic. Anyway, I'm really excited to sit down with Brad when he's here. And if anyone didn't listen to that episode, he's in town for a week and he's meeting up with people. So
just get in touch. We can connect you.
Absolutely.
And meet him for a coffee or a bite to eat or whatever, or even just jump on a call.
VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. But maybe we should cut to our talk with Andrew and Ryan. This one is perfect for the start of the year.
The Intelligentsia. Enjoy. Okay, so we're here with Andrew Ramlow, Vice President, and Ryan Berlin, Senior Economist at Rennie Intelligence, a division of Rennie Group. How you doing, guys?
Thanks for having us.
Yeah,
over.
Thanks so much for taking the time. It's kind of surprising that we've been doing this for as long as we have, and
it's been a long
you guys,
time coming.
Haven't had you guys on. Yeah,
we're honored.
You guys kept the best for last.
Can you maybe start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself? Maybe we'll start with Ryan.
Yeah, sure. So I'm an economist by education and through practice over the years. So I've been working in. So Andrew and I go back about 15, 16 years now.
Yep.
And we used to, we were running a consulting firm here in Vancouver, serving both the private sector and public sector clients, not just on issues related to real estate, but covering, I mean, our real meat and potatoes over the years has been demographic and economic analysis and forecasting. And so, when I finished my master's degree way back in 2004, ran into Andrew and his partner at the time, David Baxter, and got in the canoe and started rowing.
Yeah,
and
it's a good analogy.
And this is where we've ended up 17 years later. Yeah, so.
God, it's been that long, eh? Wow, I feel old right now, right? Yeah, and myself, ran the consulting business for a long, long time, and one of my clients over the years was Bob Rennie, and it was. In working with Bob year after year, by and large, to get a lot of his data and metrics together for his annual UDI presentation,
right.
As well as working for some of the clients that they had on the developer side of things for analysis, that we sort of cemented that working relationship. And in the last couple of years, as they've tried to what we call institutionalize Rennie, provide a little bit of a broader range of services than just the pre-sale marketing side of things and the brokerage, they asked Ryan and I to come over to basically close the consulting firm up and come in and provide those services internally to Rennie. So both with respect to the pre-sale side of things, so the developer services, but then also to the 180 agents that we have as part of the brokerage as well.
Right.
So we come at it from a little bit different perspective. Ryan has, as he said, he's got an economics background. I've got an urban planning background. So I look at things on the real estate side of things through the sort of the lens of people and land, and Ryan looks at it through the lens of the economic side of things.
Yeah, complimentary.
Yeah,
it is. Yeah, it's worked.
And so yeah, Rennie Intelligence. I think everybody knows Bob Rennie. Everybody knows Rennie Marketing and then the brokerage side. But can you guys talk a little bit about what Rennie Intelligence is? You kind of spoke to it a little bit, but
yeah, I mean we sit in house serving the needs of all, you know, parts of the business. We work directly with our brokers, our advisors, to help them better understand the market, get out in front of some of the issues, be able to communicate to their clients, buyers or sellers, what's actually happening in the market, what actually matters. And then on the developer side of things, working in with a whole range of developers in for lack of better term, the pre-sale segment of the market, we support them in the timing of making major decisions related to the launch of new projects. And then there's also we have sort of another leg to our stool, which is to project out into the marketplace a little bit and just provide our take on things, the things that we think matter within this market. So we have sort of there's sort of a number of different stakeholders within the organization and then outside of it whose needs we seek to meet.
We also provide consulting services too. So it's sort of another arm in terms of advisory services. So outside of the pre-sale development world, we work with some of the municipalities, health regions, major companies looking at notions of economic and demographic change and how that's impacting whether it be their consumer base or their particular market. So again, it's pretty wide and diverse within that sort of the Rennie fold, providing support and service internally to all of the developer clients, to the agents, but then also broadening it outside of pure real estate into more, as I said, like kind of the land using side of things.
Mm-hmm. So maybe as a first question, does Vancouver real estate make sense?
You want to clarify that?
But I mean,
what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, in my mind, a lot of people just look at prices here and there, you know, for years now, it's just incomprehensible to a lot of people, right? So I think we always talk about, you know, potentially from a global perspective or, kind of West Coast, Asian, Pacific Rim kind of perspective. But from your guys' perspective and the metrics that you're looking at, I'm curious on your take on this pretty unique market.
Yeah, prices are high. They've always been high. I mean, I think we should all accept on some level, without speaking to the specific level of prices or how they're changing. We're never going to be priced like a Regina or a Moncton or even a Calgary, right? So the housing services that are provided here when you rent or you purchase a home are, I would say, broader in the sense that, you know, this the region from an aesthetic perspective, from participating in the natural environment and enjoying the climate here and not spending money on heating and cooling as much as you might elsewhere. All of that on some level, right? On some level, factors into values. I mean, you go back a few years ago, I think we'd all agree that prices were increasing at an unsustainable level. So when we talk about price changes, 30% a year, like what they were seeing in Toronto as well, is not something that was going to be maintained over any, you know, even right. The medium term. But our prices are higher, and there's a lot of factors at play there. Migration is part of it. Job creation is part of it. When I say migration as well, I mean immigration as well. Foreign capital is part of it. We don't believe it's as big of an issue or big a contributor as some others might. But equity within the marketplace plays a significant role in influencing our prices, and we have a lot of that here.
Yeah, and from my side of things, the reality is if it didn't make sense, it'd stop working. And it hasn't stopped working. There's certainly been ups and downs, like any market. Real estate is an asset, and asset markets move up and they move down with a broad range of factors influencing them. And if at the end of the day it didn't make sense, then it would literally stop, and we haven't seen it stop.
And I think it's actually showing its resilience in a lot of ways, especially surprising people that were expecting a much more aggressive downturn in some markets, perhaps.
Yeah,
more recently.
I mean, the duration of the downturn recently was. It was protracted compared to previous downturns, but it wasn't as deep necessarily mm-hmm. as some of the others. I would say fundamentally because the factors that created it were different
yes.
from previous downturns.
Yeah.
And so that also then influences the way that we come out of it, as it appears now we have been for at least the past half year.
And largely what Rye's talking about is the policy changes that we've seen over the last 2 years. Relative to other downturns in the market that we've seen, they've largely been economically driven. And this most recent one, this is the sort of the corollary of it, is that we saw prices come down in a period where both in terms of jobs, wages, as well as population growth, we were booming here. And so it's a bit of a paradox on that side. And if anything surprised me throughout the year is that we're just getting the year-end stats in right now. And while most people say that it's been a super challenging year, we actually surpassed the number of sales in 2019 relative to 2018. So we were
in the resale market.
The resale market. So, in terms of a volume side of things, well, you know what? It's about average in terms of relative to last year, at least. We're slightly above. But that all happened in the second half of the year.
Yeah.
But the thing I think that, further to Andy's point there, that gave us confidence that the turnaround would happen, at the start of 2019, we were looking at some of the trends in resale, amongst other things, and saying by the end of the year, or as we head into fall, we expect this to turn around. And part of the faith that we had, I suppose, if you want to call it that, in the market is that behind the scenes, as sales counts came down, as inventories rose, as prices came down, behind all of that, underlying all of that, we continued to see job growth. In fact, job growth that for much of that period, that sort of year and a half, led the country or was very, very close to it when we compare Vancouver to other metro areas. We continued to see between 35 and 45,000 people a year that move here on a net basis. Those people ultimately need to be housed. People within the region, which again is growing every single year. People continue to get older every year. They have kids. They're getting married. They're getting divorced. They're dying. There's all these life changes that create different needs for housing. All those dynamics were occurring in the background. And we didn't have an unemployment rate that doubled like we did in 2009, where people literally just couldn't, you can't afford to buy a home because
right.
you have no job. People were working. We have one of the lowest unemployment rates in the entire country. People are still moving here. The demand is here. And so, we're at a place where we basically, for lack of a better term, are seeing pent-up demand accumulate. Like if you look at the number of sales adjusted for population, so like a per capita sales measure, we were in deficit relative to history for a long time, which says to us that – so the people are here. They've stepped back. They're on the sidelines. They're not participating.
And that at some point – that's got to be unleashed on the market
right.
as well. And that's that notion from an economist perspective of pent-up demand, or from a real estate side of things is people sitting on the sidelines.
Right.
And that's, again, back to sort of some of the metrics that we looked at. One, certainly this notion of a sales per capita ratio and it being well below historical averages, and saying, okay, it's at least if it comes back to its historical average, we're going to see some significant activity in the market as well. And I think that's what we've seen through the fall. Historically, you come through that sort of September to October, October, November, November, December market. And it's a time when it's not a lot of activity in the market.
Yeah.
Each of those months, you see fewer and fewer sales. And in addition to being above what we saw last year, the trend was as we went from October to November, sales were up, not down.
Yeah.
Well, November to December,
right?
Up.
Yeah.
Way up.
December was nuts.
It was a barnstorming month. Yeah.
It was. I mean, typically sales counts in December are relatively low. So that's probably not sort of the benchmark going forward, but absolutely. I mean, I think within the greater Vancouver board area, we were up around close to 90%.
Yeah.
We tend to define our region a little bit more broadly to include the Fraser Valley board area. And for your listeners who may not be totally accustomed to these boundaries, the Greater Vancouver board area obviously excludes communities like Surrey, Langley, where we see a lot of activity, where we see a lot of activity in the townhome and detached market, and where prices are, you know, 30% lower than they are elsewhere. So it's all part of a functional region. So we tend to look a bit bigger picture, and yeah, sales were up 74% in December for that broader region. So,
so if I understand correctly. The downturn, as far as you guys were seeing it, was kind of policy driven that led to potentially, I guess, a lack of confidence there for you know, whatever, maybe a year. Like, it seems like really the summer of 2018 to the summer of 2019 was that time where everybody seemed to kind of hit pause. But
well, I would say, you know, it started even earlier than that, honestly. Yeah. If you go back to...
Prices started to come down before we started to have the introduction of any of the foreign buyer's tax or anything like that.
Just anecdotally, I remember we sold a house in East Van a month before the foreign buyer's tax came in, right? And it was like, something's different. Yep. Like, that was back in 2016. I remember that open house specifically being like, we had a house a month before that where it was like... there's 100 people through, and suddenly there's only 20.
It's a little
and
you're quieter.
Like, what's going on?
It shifted quick.
It was before any policy, right?
It's interesting that you're noting that, because it's not something you hear very often. And we looked at,
especially in the media.
Yeah,
definitely. I mean, I think the government, you know, is inclined to sort of, for the most part, take credit through the policy interventions for the normalization of prices or the decline, let's call them what they are. But really, you're right. I mean, we look at price changes. They were still increasing in the spring of 2016, but they're increasing at a slowing rate. And if you look at that trend of price changes, as the increases were smaller and smaller and smaller and then became decreases, that curve was uninterrupted by the introduction of the foreign buyer's tax. It happened in and around the same time, so it was convenient in that sense. And actually, I do agree that it feeds into the psychology of and this herd mentality we talked about earlier, that the market was operating in an unsustainable way. And I would agree it was. I think there was price fatigue as well.
We had price fatigue.
Where people just go, you know what, I'm not comfortable jumping in now because I don't think that the value is there if I purchase it, you know, down the road if I purchase at this level. So I think that was part of it as well. So in addition to the policy.
Outside of people's perception of the market, some of the policies did literally take people out of the market, right?
Right. Yeah, stress
test is an interesting one. And from a prices side of things, the stress test certainly would have taken some people out of the market, those that were right at the bottom. But what it did for everybody else is it essentially cascaded them down a price range because they could afford less. So that led to a lot of price compression in the lower segments of the markets. And so when you talk about headline prices, like, well, what have average prices done? Well, that price compression is going to pull your average down from a statistical side of things. So it looks like there's this big decline in terms of average prices, right? But it's just that compression of the market and a lot more activity in the lower bands through design of the stress test. There were some people taken literally out of the market as well. It's not just 100% people's perception of where the market was going, which certainly was a case, but there was literally some movement out of the market just because of things like stress test. And, you know, we talk about a lot about policy provincially as well, locally for vacant home tax here in Vancouver. But then there's also the international policy in terms of things like trying to get money out of China and them cracking down. So, you know, as Ryan said, the international flow of capital certainly has an impact here in the lower mainland. And to, again, reiterate what Ryan said, depending on who you are, your view on that could be more or less in terms of an impact. And certainly has an impact, I think, from Ryan's and my perspective, a little bit less than what some of the people out there think. But the degree to which China is clamping down on the ability of money to get out of the country is going to have an impact here. Certainly will.
Thinking about kind of going back to 3-4 years ago, I guess 3 years ago, 2016, when you're right, like the market was changing, and then the foreign buyer's tax was the first policy shift there. Did you guys foresee the condo market take off in 2017? Like, what accounts for that? We've had various people on have different ideas as to why that happened, but like, was that Can you talk to that a little bit?
I think part of it was inventory driven. And I think too, when there's a little bit of uncertainty in the market, I think generally speaking, buyers, investors, whoever, are willing to participate at these lower price thresholds. Generally speaking, condos are going to be less expensive than their townhome or single family counterparts. And so you look at that and you look at, when we talk about demand compression when times, price compression, when there is a bit of a downturn. And so even in slower times, there is sort of a built-in, in a sense, there's built-in demand for some of that less expensive product. So in some sense, it provides a bit of a buffer to the risks that might have a bigger or the factors that might more negatively influence other segments like luxury homes, mm-hmm. luxury condos or single family homes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
we actually had somebody on our show that said that eventually with price compression, we're going to have like a condo in Langley and a house in West Vancouver, both being $1 million, jokingly,
it seems
kind of odd. And I'd love to kind of hear your guys' thoughts on the luxury market, which seems to be still, very stagnant. Much a buyer's market, very yeah. stagnant in certain submarkets. What happens with the luxury market from here, and how what's the interplay and how does that impact kind of the markets, the entry level and mid level markets where a lot of buyers are?
Yeah, that's a good question. In terms of the trickle down side of things, and this has been talked about a lot, talked about a lot with respect to things like, well, Westside Detached leading the market as a whole. So for all product types and all geographies, and we ran it statistically and there's absolutely no correlation between that. So it does, the luxury market does work, I'd say, independently of the rest of the market, i.e. there's not a whole lot of trickle down. Mm-hmm. Your $4 million house on the west side, it doesn't really have a lot of implications for your $500,000 condo in Surrey. But it depends on what your perspective on it is. Right now, if you look at West Van as a whole in terms of the market, the number of sales in that West Van market, it's relatively consistent with what it has been historically. If we look back over time, what's changed in the West Van market is the number of listings that are out there. So from a purchaser's perspective, well, it's good times because there's a lot of variety out there for them to choose from. But if you're selling something, well, it's a very competitive market because mm-hmm. of the number of listings that are out there that you have to compete with. So I think that at least in the short term, it's that luxury market is still going to be relatively flat, especially to the degree that we were relying on incomes outside of the Lower Mainland here to drive that, whether that be somebody coming here from retiree from Toronto or somebody from overseas. So I think it'll be a little bit longer before it certainly comes back, especially given the number of listings that are out there right now that are populating those higher segments of the market.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think the way to characterize it is more of a plateauing in prices, and yeah, the recovery, the timing of a recovery in that segment, anyone's guess, right? But I think what we can say is if we look at the other direction the prices can move, and that is down, again, we go back to this issue of the origin of the downturn. And we're not in a situation like we've been in past years where economic conditions change rapidly and people have to sell. So they list because they have to, and then they take what they can get. I mean, certainly there are some people that are always in that position, mm-hmm. unfortunately. But what we have now is in some markets, we'll have people choosing not to list. And this is where, going back to the price changes overall, I mean, we saw like a 20% decline, I think, year over year recently in average sales prices. It's not that any one of our homes or your homes out there of your listeners went down by that much. It's that the activity moved down market, right? So people weren't listing their homes in some of the higher price bands. They're waiting for conditions to turn around. And so when we calculate average prices and we go by that as sort of an indicator of the health of the market, sometimes it's a little bit misleading, because if the composition of the housing is fundamentally different at one time versus another time in terms of the type of housing, the location of housing within the region that's transacting, it can give a bit of a skewed picture.
Right. It creates the perception of the value going down.
That's all right. Of our prices came down by 20% when really they didn't. There was a decline, but it wasn't 20% across the board. That's right. For sure.
Well, I think I've said it on the show before. Like, I had a client who bought a little one bedroom condo in Kits, in basically at the peak, like late 2017. He said, "I'm going to be here forever. I don't care." Of course, he moves. He's now in Montreal. But actually, I mean, he didn't make any money, but we sold it for more than he paid for it in August. And it's like around the 500K mark. And I mean, that even surprised me looking at it. But that market, I guess, it's worth pointing out, right? Where the house down the street has come down, you know, X amount, that one bedroom condo is actually, if anything, kind of stayed at the same price or risen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I guess it's just also worth noting, too, that the board tracks what they call their HPI, so their price index, which is supposed to get around this issue of averages and having a big impact on the top side or on the bottom side and swaying the average value up and down. So that's supposed to be tracking a similar house or similar characteristics for a house or a condo over time to get rid of that big variance on the statistical side. And I guess it's also just worth noting the most recent month over month price data for all product types in Lower Mainland as a whole saw an increase.
Right.
So this was the first month of change that we saw. Rather than being flat, it is a slight uptick. I'm not going to say that 1 month makes a trend, but we have seen 1 month of the December numbers were up across the board for the HPI index for all product types.
Right. Just thinking about this idea of that this downturn was different because, you know, all the economic indicators, jobs, everything else, immigration, everything's kind of on the up and up, and yet we're seeing a downturn, and that's kind of the difference there. It's interesting because a lot of people we've talked to and a lot of listeners, I think, of this podcast were thinking, okay, there's going to be, you know, these guys that have to sell. There's going to be a crisis at some point where, you know, there's going to be a flood of inventory. And it seems like really what's happened at the end of 2019 was people just saying, well, we're not going to list. Like, we don't have to sell. Mm-hmm. It's not a great time to sell. We're not going to sell. And then inventory went way down, right?
Exactly.
Now, the question that I feel like at least I get, I think you get as well, on a daily basis is, are we going to have better inventory in the spring? And I think there's a little bit more confidence now than there was, say, in July or August, right? And we're hoping that for the sake of some of our buyers is going to shake out some of the inventory. Like, what are your guys' thoughts on inventory this spring? Is it going to be up?
Yeah.
And what impact does that have on the market?
Well, I would hope so. Like, yeah. I'm with you on that. I really, really dislike hearing situations where people are in no subjects, multiple offers. And like, mm-hmm. it, certainly from somebody vending it, selling, it's a great thing. But nonetheless, it makes it a very, very challenging purchase. And I would think that as market sentiment changes and the general market sees a bit of an uptick with regard to level of sales and at least a flat lining, maybe a slight increase in prices, that as Rai said, they may be inclined to get back into the market and get their listings out there if they have been sitting on the sidelines. So I would hope that there would be a bit of an expansion on the inventory side of things.
Yeah, I mean, I think undoubtedly we'll see more homes available for purchase in the spring compared to where we are
now
in the depths of really the depths.
December, January.
January. Yeah. But the year-over-year change in inventory beginning in September of last year, just sort of big picture overall, started to reverse. So inventory started to contract on a year-over-year basis. So there was in December, the available units were way down over what was available in December of 2018. So I think a lot of that depends on how long this so-called resurgence in demand maintains itself. Because that eats into that inventory, right? So if you know, we have this flow of new listings every month, if sales activity is robust, then it doesn't allow the listings to accumulate. And so, as of right now, sales, I mean, there's nothing that we're looking at that says sales are going to slow down in the very near term. So that really becomes a question of how many people want to jump in with our own listing. But it gets to, we're starting to ask questions that we may not have answers to, which is, you know, what are the motivations for selling? Who needs to sell versus who wants to sell? And so it's really nuanced. And again, some of these questions are, I think, harder to answer for us directionally. When we talk directionally, or even the magnitude of some of the trends in the market are difficult to assess, given the nature of the cycle that we've just come through and the causes of it.
And I'm just going to throw onto that. The reason why some of those questions are really hard for us to answer is because we always try and take a quantitative or empirical look at things. And some of them you just can't throw. There's not one magic metric you can look at. And so you start to throw as many metrics at it as we look at it within sort of our Rennie intelligence framework. And sometimes at best they become muddled. And so we can, at that point, it becomes maybe some educated guesses about where things are going to go.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe moving on to the pre-sale market, because I know that's one of the areas that you guys focus on. Obviously, it almost in a lot of ways kind of seems the tale of two markets with the resale market and the pre-sale market. What's happening in pre-sales right now? And maybe also the last quarter of 2019, what did we... How did pre-sales perform?
Well, right now we don't really know. There hasn't because there hasn't been any launches.
Yeah, right.
So it's very challenging on that side. We've got a project that's coming up for launch within the next couple of weeks in Burnaby Highline. So I think us as well as the rest of the market are really keeping an eye on that to see how we kick off 2020 on that side of things, as a bit of a bellwether and indicator and where the rest of it's going to go. But you guys are right. In terms of 2019, we ended off the year at a relatively low point with respect to the number of units that were launched. We don't have quite all the numbers in yet, but we're looking probably about 50% below our historical average. So somewhere just over 7,000 units were launched.
That were launched or sold?
Okay, sold. And then, but on that, we actually see an inventory of unsold in the range of about 9,000 units. Again, haven't all told it yet. We're just sort of getting all the year-end numbers in right now. But relative to history, if I look back through the pre-sale side of things, 2010 to 2018 averaged about 14,000 sales. And our standing inventory, so the released but unsold, averages about 6,600 units. And so we're certainly way down on the sales side, 50%, but we're up on the unsold inventory side of things, which is not necessarily a bad thing. Back to my West Van example, depending on whether you're the developer or whether you're a purchaser,
if you're buying,
this is not necessarily a bad thing as well. There's certainly a growing range of opportunities for you to look at if you're looking at getting into the market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, sorry, I was just going to say, I mean, absolutely the resale and pre-sale market are their own beasts to some extent, but there is an interplay there. And I think a lot of that is channeled through just consumer sentiment. And so this is where we're really interested to follow what happens in the resale market, because I think that will start to shed some light on how the pre-sale market will evolve. I mean, if we have a lot more activity within resale and inventories get drawn down and prices start to increase, one, it closes the gap between the resale and pre-sale prices a little bit. But then I think people start to feel a little bit more positive directionally about where things are going.
Yeah, where they might land 3 to 4 years from now. They get
exactly.
The keys, right?
Yep. You give your money up now, and then you hope that the value is there in three or 4 years. Right. And I think that confidence has not been there. And this is where sometimes the data may tell us one thing, and it doesn't really matter. If prices are recovering, but people don't think that they are, then that's the thing that matters.
Mm-hmm. They're going to wait.
And I think the resale market has not reestablished itself well enough at this point for us to make definitive statements about the pre-sale market. But we do know that, you know, working with many, many developers throughout the region, a lot of them are sitting there waiting to launch projects. So stuff has been not shelved permanently. They haven't moved on from these projects. They're there. They're almost ready to go. But it's just a matter of timing. Yep. So we will see more activity, you know, over the next 2 to 3 years, undoubtedly, on the pre-sale side.
What does it take? I'm just thinking here. So we've had basically positive news for close to 6 months now. What does it take to for the reestablished? You said it hasn't reestablished itself well enough at this point. Like, what does it take
for buyer sentiment?
Yeah, I mean, well, just in the resale market.
Yeah, I agree. Well, what we haven't seen is prices move very much, mm-hmm. right? So that's sort of the indicator that conditions have actually changed. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing more transactions, but we're not seeing the bidding up of prices, broadly speaking.
Yeah.
You can find any number of individual sure. properties where that is the case. And then you'll find cases where stuff is selling way below ask. So it's really a mixed bag still. There's not the euphoria that we saw from like 2016 early on. Right. But I think what we need to see is for values to start changing direction. They've stopped declining. We know that. Mm-hmm. Assessments notwithstanding. Yes. I assume all your listeners know that we all just got our assessment notices.
We all just got creamed on the assessment side.
But that was the fascinating thing. Were you going to talk about the inflection?
No, I was actually going to say it. I just wanted to jump in and say it's you're talking about prices as well. I think what the market needs is a spring market that's active in terms of the volume side of things. We went through, you look back historically, we went through long periods of time here in the Lower Mainland where we saw very little price increases. Still a healthy market. Mm-hmm. So we don't need year over year significant price increases for the market to be healthy here. What we need is confidence from the consumer side of things, that they feel confident in listing their houses, that they're going to get the prices that they want or are able to get. And then on the purchasing side of things, people to be able to move into the market and have the expectation of a year and two that, well, it might not be a 30% increase, but it's not going to be a 10% decline.
Right.
So I think that's what needs to come back in the market. And I'm hoping that that is established through the spring market. So inflection point, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say that's...
Did someone say inflection? Yeah. Well, no. So, I mean, it's sort of like the market took two steps forward and then we all got our assessments and it was like one step back. Everyone's like, wait, what's actually going on here?
Yeah.
And of course, those assessments... the process notwithstanding, but the assessments themselves are dated to July 1, right? So there's their values as of 6 months ago compared to values from, you know, July 1st, 2018. So the interesting thing is July 1, you could say, is actually when our market really turned. So that marked the halfway point. Yeah,
it literally was. That's when the inflection point in terms of sales were. It was in the middle of the summer and we saw it go from a negative sales gap to a positive sales gap. And so that's that point. And this is an interesting one we kick around at the office all the time. And we've now had 6 months of flat and 1 month of increasing prices. And coming around to the assessments for next year, it's going to take the last 6 months of 2019 and the first 6 months of 2020. So the degree that we see flat or slightly increasing prices in the next 6 months, it's going to result in an increase in the next assessed values. So again, it's that notion of
which you won't get until December of
the fall of the year after that. That's right. Yeah. So it's the assessments are challenging at best because I think that a lot of people don't really understand one how they're generated or what it really means. That doesn't mean that my house now is worth 20% less than what it was.
If anything, just let them inform how much you pay in tax.
That's what
that's right. Yes.
Exactly. Like really, like that's all they're.
That's what they're there for.
That's what they're. Well, and that really is what it is. And even that, people look at the decline in the value of their homes and they think, oh, or flip it around. When we were seeing significant increases, they're saying like, oh my God, what does that mean for my taxes?
Yeah.
And again, they're two separate things. The city comes along, any of the cities come along, given what the asset value is, they know what their operating budgets are and they know what the bucket of assessed values are. And they say, okay, well, how do we adjust what they call the mill rate so that we can pay all the stuff
keep
that we
the
have
library
to,
lights on.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Keep everybody employed. And so it's not, you know, it's that big increase in value or the big decrease in value isn't necessarily going to result in a big increase or decrease on your taxes side of things as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like so many people are asking about assessed values right now, and it's a lot of them, like I was saying to somebody last night, I was involved in a multiple offer situation in South Vancouver where the house in November sold, I think it was November, maybe early December, sold for over 1.5, whatever it was, 1.53, 1.54. And my client who wrote on that house and didn't get it just sent me the new assessed value and it's 1.2 something. You're like, okay. So, and it went down like 150K or something like that. And you're like, huh, this is, outdated at best. I don't think it was ever worth 1.2 something either. I think it was always worth more than that.
No, but again, how BC assessment calculates that, what it means is that there was a couple of homes in that particular area that sold under the 1.5.
Yeah, right.
And they take those values and they have an algorithm that they stick it to and they take the value from last year and say, oh, well, look at what sold here. The average was 1.2, not 1.5. So everybody's got to come down.
Well, and assessors don't walk through your house and say, I love what you've done with the place.
It was amazing.
Exactly. So for the most part, that stuff gets lost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think and unfortunately, it gets lost on the general public too, because it's not communicated really well from BC Assessment.
Right. Just call your local Rennie or Oakwin realtor.
Thanks, guys.
And I'll explain it.
And they will explain it to you. Okay, so kind of shifting gears a little bit, because I know we don't have you guys for too much longer, but there's some kind of burning questions that Matt and I have here. So,
all right.
So the first one is where do you see the biggest risk to the market over the next 1 or 2 years from your perspectives?
So I always, given the lens I look through at
economic
the market,
side. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at what are some of those economic factors. I mean, we've had since 2009, we have seen a very sustained, what was a protracted recovery. Now it's just slow growth, but we've been growing for an almost unprecedented amount of time without having another downturn. So, I would say economic expansions don't die of old age. I stole that from The Economist magazine.
Somebody's listening to qualify that. Yeah.
But it's a really good line because
cite your sources.
That's what we do.
Yeah, we do. That's right. Well versed on that front.
I say that because I always feel like if we're not in a recession, we're talking about when the next one's coming. And I guess if you beat that drum long enough, eventually you'll be right. But when we look at the actual underlying, fundamentals in Canada, in BC, in this region, they've been good. So at some point you wonder, do these the disruption of international supply change because the U.S. and China are having a trade tiff or Brexit, these kinds of things, or the Strait of Hormuz gets closed, or something that creates a lot of uncertainty. That's the kind of thing where if there is uncertainty, we know that consumers in the housing market don't play in that sandbox. If they don't have a sense for where things are going, same with businesses. If the future is uncertain, they're not making big investments in technology and people and that kind of thing. So to me, we're always looking for signs that, the economy is starting to trend down, because I think, if we see an unemployment rate that goes up significantly, if people aren't earning income, they're not going to be able to afford their homes. And that's where we see a real challenge. So for me, I'm looking at that. There's nothing right now. I think we've been fairly positive about our economy for even through a period where a lot of people were calling for its demise. And I wouldn't say we're in the clear now by any stretch of the imagination, but I think some of those fears have receded. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we're always watching that, amongst other things.
So what's your other economist quote there?
Oh, I was wondering if you guys asked us to predict where pricing was going.
Oh, that was my next question.
Okay, so give the quote for a second there.
Well, I was going to say that it's been said that economic forecasting was invented to make astrology look respectable. So, okay. So don't engage in price forecasting.
So given what Ryan said just about outlook about the economy side, I've got an easier job of it because I look at it from sort of the supply side of things. And I think one of the risks, not necessarily within the next 2 years, but going a little bit farther than that is supply. Supply and policy. Right now, you look at there's been a big focus on the demand side, nationally, provincially, locally, in terms of trying to quell demand side ventures. But there's not been a lot of focus on the supply side. And right now, post our election and a slate of new municipal councils through the whole of the region, we're seeing development proposals at third reading getting quashed by councils throughout the region. And that's at some point, if that continues, if that sentiment around the council tables continues, it is going to put a bit of a pinch on the supply side of things. And the reality is, in terms of looking longer term forward, this region within the next 20 to 25 years is going to accommodate a million more folks is what our projection, as well as, you know, other BC Stats and other people are forecasting. And, you know, that's like, for context, that's like adding another city of Vancouver, Burnaby, the North Shore, and Richmond to this region in 23 years.
Wow.
Never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
So, all those people need a place to live.
Jeez.
Right?
Yep. So it again, it puts that a little bit of a different context to it. It frames it in a little bit of a different way. And we're going to need to accommodate also a growing job base. Our economic models say that it could be upwards of about 500,000 new jobs as well within the region. And we're not making any more land.
Yeah.
Right.
So those are some of the longer term metrics that Ryan and I look at. And I look at not necessarily opportunity within the market, but, you know, what are some of the driving factors? Yeah. Opportunity is subjective given what your particular objectives are. But those are some of the broader realities as well, especially as federal immigration targets move up to 350,000 people next year in terms of immigration targets. Of the BC bound immigrants, the Lower Mainland gets about 90% of them.
So that means we get, because BC gets in around 15-16% of Canada's immigrants, this region gets about 14% of Canada's
of
immigrants.
All Canada's, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So we
right.
punch way above our weight with respect to our share of immigrants. And there's some real implications there as well. We also, on the interprovincial side of things, you know, this is where people are coming for the jobs, for education as well. So we have the interprovincial side of things as well.
And I will just make just one statement here for anybody sort of thinking about why these immigration targets are so high. Why do people come here? The reason that Canada has increased its immigration targets, and my guess is they will continue to step them up, is specifically to deal with issues related to an aging population nationally, but also within more or less within every province and every market, and the impact that has on our workforce, right? That is growing more slower and slower and slower. And so the types of people that we are welcoming into the country are people that are – for the most part, they fall into the economic class of immigration. So they'll have a certain level of skills, education. They will have been working in particular fields at certain income levels. And so they're able to contribute to our economic base. And that's, you know, we talk about, you know, we ask the question of who's going to change our, you know, parents' bedpans or ours, you know, in 20, 30 years or whatever it is. And the reality is, we're not replacing ourselves with a fertility rate that's been below replacement for four decades.
Right.
If we didn't have migration, our population would be declining.
Right.
So the consequence of an aging population with a low fertility rate is migration is the way that we sustain our economy. But that means then we have to think about the impacts of that. And one of the impacts that immigration has is on our housing market.
Yeah. So the GDP gets larger, but the housing stock gets smaller, right? That's basically, well, yeah, at least as of right now.
Well, we need to figure out ways to add supply of all types of homes. So for sale, rental, which has really come up, purpose-built rental, after many, many years of very little investment into new purpose-built rental, we're finally seeing that. But we need the full spectrum of housing to be added consistently over time.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a region or a sub-market that you're excited about?
I wouldn't say sub-region. I'd say not particularly geographically, but there are certain areas within the Lower Mainland. You know, we talk about this a lot at the office with Bob as sort of the emerging energy centers within the region. Surrey, certainly an emerging energy center, given what they're doing at Surrey City Center. In Burnaby, Metrotown, Brentwood, evolving energy centers as well. And how we're classifying those is areas that it's not just housing that they're adding. They're adding a diversity of uses as well. Surrey City Center is probably the best example in terms of a huge diversity of uses going in down there, from education to office to housing as well. But there's also this notion of interconnectivity that is driving those energy centers, and that's the transit network that's sure. That's established around it. And you look at, if we look back historically as well, the success of MC Squared in the Marine Gateway area, highly, highly connected, and it evolved around that transit node, and their energy center is developing as they're adding the other uses around there mm-hmm. as well, mm-hmm. not just growing the housing stock, but the other services that are around there. So, you know, that I guess by default that points to, okay, the energy center's in Surrey and Burnaby Metrotown and Brentwood, but I'd say that there are other smaller energy centers that are emerging throughout the region as well. And it's that notion of diversity of use, as well as being highly interconnected.
Mm-hmm. SkyTrains seem to be so central to that. Just even, I mean, we had Kevin Desmond, CEO of TransLink, yep. on recently, and he was talking about the million people that are coming over the next 20 to 30 years and where are we going to put them. But even just talking about Marine Gateway area and just thinking in contrast to River District, yeah. which doesn't have a train, right? And what that has done in terms of demand and price point. Right, but it's very interesting to think of all the
what and if you were in the city of Vancouver asking for a friend here,
I know this guy.
Yeah, what? Because we're talking Surrey, we're talking Brentwood, Metrotown. Exciting spot in the city of Vancouver that you guys are talking about?
You live here, Andy. I moved away.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is where you really have to know your clients, because for one particular client, they may say like a River District is exactly what I want. Yeah. I don't need to be interconnected, but you know what? I want to go and be able to walk along the river.
Sure.
I want to take my dog out. So this is where it becomes really important to know your clients. And because for one, a really great opportunity may be the worst decision they'd ever make. Mm-hmm. So, but again, back to sort of being interconnected, I look at some of the stuff that's happening like out along Kingsway. Great. I'm going to say that's like the next rapid transit corridor in terms of not SkyTrain, but right, buses.
But rapid bus. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Rapid bus in along that. And, you know, again, you can get out to Burnaby Metrotown and get out onto the system that way. You can get down to Science World down here where we're close to where we're sitting and get around. This area down here is certainly going to emerge and evolve a lot, building on what's happened at the Athletes Village as that sort of continues to move eastward as well. So I think regardless of... you really need to define who you are, what your objectives are in terms of real estate, and you'll be able to find a gem anywhere within the city. And some of the people that could go for the luxury market as well in terms of some of the opportunities, and it could go for your first-time home buyer who's wants to get into a 450 square foot condo.
Right. I know you guys are loath to talk about...
I think we've got about 5 minutes left here, and I think I know, Andrew, you have to get going. Maybe we should shift to the five.
Okay, wire. Okay.
Have man, time
I was
for the
gonna.
Five
that wire. Was sure. I was. That was gonna be good.
But. oh, we got.
Yeah. Sure.
We'll leave it for your guys' time.
Well, no. Okay. Well, this is the last question because
we'll do it quick.
Okay. Yeah.
Speed round.
So no yeah, thing. This is. this would actually be good as a speed round because, no one wants to predict pricing in the short, mid, or long term here. I think we know where you guys stand on the long term. Mm-hmm. But if somebody's thinking about, you know, we've seen month over month increase in sales here. Have we bottomed? What does 2020 look like? And kind of the 3 to 5 year terms in terms of prices.
In three words or less.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Just give me percentages.
Yeah. Just,
how many decimal places do you want? So again, you know, I look at how our economy is functioning, how many jobs we're adding, how our population is growing, and all that stuff points to sustained need for housing and different types of housing. But then also on this issue of pent-up demand, when we look at these per capita sales ratios, again, so number of sales given, you know, per, you know, a certain number of people in the region, we're below what our historical average is. And we're starting to get back to that average. But there's a long period where we're below. So that is the pent-up demand that needs to be pushed through. I see that factoring in 2020. And so I think prices... Do you want me to go out on a limb here?
Yeah.
out on that limb. So overall, you know, I don't see prices going down at all in 2020. And I'm not going to give you a percentage going up, but directionally, I see them going up. The big but in all of this is
nobody's in the business of forecasting one-off unexpected events, right? So if the provincial government says they don't like the way the market's trending, they might try to do something. And it's not, I'm not saying that to spook people. What I'm saying is, you know, there are certain factors that come into play that aren't part of any kind of trend analysis or part of the day-to-day fundamentals that we consider. And of course that could happen.
Right.
So I'm just sort of a bit of an asterisk there on my prediction.
It also goes for the economy side of things, not just in terms of provincial or local policy. If something globally transpired like 2008, where there was a financial crisis, that would certainly add some variance in there. But with respect to the metrics that we look at and we track, I'm not going to say that there's going to be a big bump in prices, but there's certainly not a lot of downward pressure on prices given how things are evolving right now in the short term.
Perfect.
Okay, now we'll get to the five-wire.
Yeah, five-wire, five lighthearted questions to end the conversation as described by Secret on the sheet in front of me. Okay, so question number one, we'll start with Andrew. What is your favorite neighborhood in Vancouver?
Well, obviously the neighborhood that I live in, Fraserhood. So I'm sort of a Fraserhood area. I've been there for a long time, watched it change from literally being crack houses on the corner to
Faubourgeois.
And it's probably my second favorite restaurant. Yeah, yeah. There you go.
Good transition.
So of course, my neighborhood. So Inland Valley. And we moved there about 5 years ago. We had kids in Vancouver and thought we'd raise them in Vancouver. And then all of a sudden it was like we could live on the North Shore. It's where my wife grew up. And the access to the trails, nature. Our restaurants aren't as good. I think we have a Browns and a Black Bear pub.
Black Bear pub. That's a good good spot. Next question. Favorite bar or restaurant?
Restaurant. Salvia Volpe.
Okay, oh, so you're nice. Staying in the...
I'm in the...
You're hood. Walking. You're walking
I'm walking
you go.
The walk. I'm talking the talk for Fraserhood, yeah.
Yeah, I know. I'm staying in the hood, too. So I'm going back to Black Bear.
I thought you were going to say Browns.
No. I would have smacked him if that was the case.
Best French fries in the city.
There's no pretense at the Black Bear. I love it.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. One piece of advice that you would give your 18-year-old self.
Oh, I always love these questions. This is going to sound kind of flippant. I'm going to say respect your elders. One of the things that I've learned over the years is as a young person, establish a good set of mentors for yourself and rely on them, especially in today's day and age. As Ryan talked about, a little bit of an aging population as well. There's so much knowledge built up within all industries. I think as a younger 18-year-old, I had the opportunity, as I say, to sort of stand on the shoulders of giants and learn my trade and my craft and my interests. And I would say that that's what anybody who's young and moving into the job market should
look
to.
That's a great one.
Yeah. Especially as I get older.
Yeah, exactly. I don't like giving unsolicited advice, but this was solicited. So I would, you know, I don't know what your demographic is of listeners, but, you know, for the younger ones, it's enjoy being young. Life's always got its challenges. I remember what it was like to be 18. I remember being in university and I was poor and I was stressed and I thought, this is so hard. And I look back, I remember somebody at that time said, this is going to be the best 4 years of your life. And I was like, you're bonkers. Yeah. It's so hard. I mean, I had a great time. We knew how to party. We knew how to have fun and made so many lifelong friends, but it was hard. It was stressful. And you look back and you go, those were the four best years of my life.
Yeah. I didn't know what stress was.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. I definitely wasn't changing diapers back then. So. Yeah.
God.
A book you would recommend?
I'm just getting through Malcolm Gladwell's Talking to Strangers, which is an interesting one.
Oh, that's his new one.
His new
right?
one, yeah. I would suggest picking it up. It's a really interesting read. I'm not going to give away any of the contents, but it's a relatively good one, yeah.
So a couple of years ago, I read a book called The Golden Spruce about this guy, Grant Hadwin, who it all takes place on the West Coast here in Haida Gwaii, and he was a sort of semi-unbalanced wilderness lover. And the writing in it, it's so descriptive as I was reading it, I felt like I was watching a movie. Like I was reading in color. It was absolutely unbelievable. I would recommend that book to
anyone. Based on a true story.
Yeah.
It is a true story.
Yeah. Wow.
Golden Spruce.
Oh, that sounds really good, actually.
Yeah. It's a good one.
Great read. Especially if you live on the West Coast.
Yeah. Right on. Last, something you have bought recently, last year or two, for under $1,000, it has absolutely changed your life.
or a little bit.
Or a little bit. I'd probably say skis for my little girl. It's changed my life because now I'm back on the mountain every Sunday morning. And to look at the smile on her face when she's busting down the mountain, especially when there's 50 centimeters of fresh snow like there was on Sunday.
Yeah. You were out on Sunday. I was out on Friday night, and it was incredible. It was hard to get. We were at Cypress. It was hard to get there. But, man, once you were there.
Took me an hour and a half to get up, Seymour. But once we were there, again, it was the giggles as she unpacked herself from under the snow and gathered her stuff back up after a big crash. That was just that's the life-changing
stuff. Yeah. Right on.
Great one.
I feel like we're doing a lot of product marketing here. So my purchase that's changed my life is a pair of slippers. Glare Ups is the brand.
Wait, Glare Ups?
Glare Ups.
Seriously? We'll link to it in the show notes.
It's a mouthful. If you rearrange the letters, it spells splurge. So they're a little expensive. They're wool, and I just wear them all the time. They're on my feet through the summer, the winter. All the time.
What? Glare Ups? Glare Ups. That's the name. Glare Ups.
I have no idea what that means.
We're going to kick you out if you wear them to the office.
That's right.
Well, that was a phenomenal conversation, guys. I could have did that all day.
Yeah, no
very,
kidding.
Very interesting. But thanks again for joining us. We really appreciate it. It's been a long time coming.
And we know you guys send out monthly reports. Oh, how can people find out more about what you guys are doing?
So if you jump onto the Rennie.com website, there's an intelligence page there that people can go and there's access to our recent reports and stuff that are there. But they can also sign up and you can get your name in to actually receive stuff automatically as well. As we produce the Rennie Review, which is our monthly take on the resale market. We also have a pre-sale snapshot document that we put together, as well as the Rennie Landscape, which is probably one of our bigger ones. That's a quarterly roll-up of the big economic and demographic factors that we see unfolding. And again, that's sort of that from the national right down to the local level here. So that's another good one. But if folks just jump onto Rennie.com.
/intelligence.
And we'll put a link. We'll put a link for sure as well. And I should say, this is like one of the emails I get from the many lists that I'm on that I actually open and read.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, it is. You guys are doing amazing work.
We appreciate those comments. That's why we go back to the office. So thanks for that.
Yeah. Right on. Okay, thanks guys.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Appreciate it.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Andrew Ramlow and Ryan Berlin from Rennie Intelligence.
Really enjoyed that conversation, Matt. And the crazy thing about that chat was that we talked for what felt like 15 minutes, and then we got the notice that we were up around like 45 minutes and that we were getting close to the end of the program. And I feel like we barely scratched the surface.
The nice thing is they said they'd come back.
Yeah.
And they do quarterly deep dives.
Yeah.
And they said they'd come back.
Well, we're super excited, and we're going to link to their mailing list and some of the reports. And, you know, if you are interested in Vancouver real estate and you're following our stuff, you should definitely be on the list to get the reports from Ryan and from Andrew, because, man, are they doing interesting things. And they're constantly just analyzing stats over there. And they look at the pre-sale market. They look at the resale market. They're just involved.
That's right. No, there's no reason why you shouldn't be on that list. You know what other list you should be on?
I think I have a feeling where you're going with this.
This is a live wire. This is over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. There's no reason why you shouldn't be on this list.
I thought we're rebranding now. We've just had Rennie Intelligence on. I thought we were going to go with Scalina Average IQ, somewhere between 70 and 130.
Maybe closer to 70.
Yeah. Well, it's just one of us brings it down to 70. One of us brings it up to 130.
The rebrand is a work in progress here.
Yeah.
I don't know if we can carry it across the finish line.
Yeah. Maybe we'll stick with VREP.
Yeah. But this is to get back to our email list here.
Yeah.
We're sending out updates about the podcast, Vancouver Real Estate Live, the YouTube show. We're sending out stats you can't get anywhere else. We got deal of the month.
Yes.
We got assignments. I mean, there's no reason you shouldn't be on this list.
No, you should absolutely be on this list, Matt. And we've also got tools like private client services, because if you're not using PCS, Matt, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor level information at your fingertips. It's free. It's the best resource out there. And you can sign up at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Sign up over there. But what else do we got before we go? Well, if you want to see what Andrew Ramlow and Ryan Berlin look like,
yes,
this will be on YouTube. It's coming up on Thursday, so go over there.
That's a good-looking group on that YouTube.
Yeah, that's a star-studded.
You go
cast
for the real right estate. You stay for the what would you call us? The Ocean's 11 cast.
Yeah. More or less.
Yeah.
But you can head over to YouTube to see that. Subscribe to our channel.
Right.
This is where you get updates for Vancouver Real Estate Live and all the rest. But I think we'll leave it there. If you have any questions about anything you heard today, anything at all real estate related, you can get a hold of me at any time, 778-847-2854 or matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
We also got that secret line.
info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Gets slower every time. It's like we slowed that down on purpose. Is he getting slower at saying that? It's great. It's surprising because he actually is the person that brings it up to IQ 130. Just speak slow.
Have a good week, guys.
2000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.